Welcome to A Healthy Curiosity, the podcast that explores what it takes to be well in a busy world with self-care strategies from Chinese medicine. I'm your host, Brody Welch, here to support you on your journey of health, happiness, and personal evolution. Welcome to A Healthy Curiosity. On today's show, I am really pleased to have my dear sister, Dr. Claudia Welch, join me to basically just decompress about this intense, momentous week that we've just had in the United States with the presidential election, and just what a different world it feels like than the one we were in just a few days ago. Claudia is the author of two amazing books, Balance Your Hormones, Balance Your Life, Achieving Optimal Health and Wellness Through Ayurveda, Chinese Medicine, and Western Science, and How the Art of Medicine Makes the Science More Effective, Becoming the Medicine We Practice, both of which are amazing. She is a doctor of oriental medicine, an Ayurvedic practitioner, and an international speaker, and of course, most importantly, she is my sister, who I love dearly. Technically, I guess she's my half-sister. We grew up in separate households, and we'd only see each other a few times a year. She was like this beloved aunt figure in my life back then. But we did get to live near each other for a little over 3 years when I was going to acupuncture school at Southwest Acupuncture College, and she was practicing in Albuquerque. And I've learned a ton from her over the years, both formally and informally, and was really looking forward to geeking out with her on some of the nerdier aspects of Ayurveda and Chinese medicine and yoga and how that applies to our lives, which we both love talking about. But our heads are really not there today. We're still both kind of reeling a bit from this election, which seems like a sea change for our country. So, today we're going to talk about what is helpful in getting through this time where so much feels uncertain. So Claudia, thanks so much for taking the time to be willing to talk with me and this community.
Oh, it's just really sweet. It's so sweet to be here. For one thing, just to be with everybody who loves Brody, because gosh, we have something in common, because I really love Brody. and I like finding those common threads of love right now. And you know, in terms of very recent things that have helped me, just before Brody hit the record button for today's session, we took a minute or two to just kind of go inside. And for me, I like to bring my lineage in when we're about to speak publicly and share a space together. And I just felt this overwhelming light and love. And that, for me right now, is extraordinarily helpful. It's just, to me, there's the different bodies. You know, in India, we call them the koshas, the sheaths. There's the physical sheath, the annamaya kosha, they call it, and the prana sheath, which you could say chi, the chi body, the life force body. And then there's the manomaya kosha, the mental body. And all of these things, to me, feel very much like they are in flux right now, that they're rearranging. And getting my head out of the process and allowing those to rearrange has been my MO in the last few days for a number of reasons that I would love to talk about. But before we started this call and we had this minute and just kind of going in, there's like this inner point that's even deeper than the annamaya kosha and the pranamaya kosha and the manomaya kosha, the physical body, the prana body, the mental body. There's something beyond that that is, and deeper than that, that is so stable and so light. And underneath the experience of all of these koshas, all of these sheaths, this matrix in which I exist, feeling like this matrix is changing and shifting and reorganizing and rearranging underneath that, it is just so helpful to touch that part that isn't changing, that is stable, that is light, that is love, that is okay, that, you know, it doesn't sort of transcend that, but it depthifies that, you know, it infuses all these bodies with its life force, and it itself is stable. And that is what is helping me right in this very moment.
Amen, sister. Yes, absolutely. That is, it's one of those weeks where it's like, just being able to touch that for just a minute, it is, I don't know what I would do without that. I honestly have no idea. Getting to that place, yeah, it's hopeful. It allows
it
you mentioned a feeling of things rearranging, and I'm wondering if you could expound on that a little bit more. I mean, I get certainly the sense of the shifting sands of the political outlook and sort of the what world are we in now that feels like a sea change, and what is my relationship to that world? And for me, that was very clarifying of values, like that sort of like, well, what is mine to do was a question that came up almost immediately in a way that like very rarely do I feel like I am obliged to answer a question that arises internally. But it was one of those like, get clear on this. I haven't answered it yet, but it's certainly like, I feel like it's an assignment from within. You know, you mentioned getting out of your head and letting there be some rearranging. And I'd like to know how that feels for you and how you've been allowing that to unfold.
Well, first of all, I'd really love to tie it to a concept that has been coming into my heart and mind in these last few days, which is this concept. There's a Sanskrit word, sutaka, which relates to it very beautifully. This feeling felt familiar to me after the morning after the election, what this feeling was. It felt familiar, but I couldn't quite place it for a little bit. And then I realized, I know what this feeling is. I have been present at deaths before and lost people I really love to death and been present at a lot of births. And there's this period of time that they talk about in India in Sanskrit called sutaka. And this sutaka word is a very interesting word. It relates to a time and experience of profound transition. So specifically, it is usually used in the context of births and deaths, but because those are powerful transitions, but it's also used as it relates to the Sanskrit words for charioteer, which a charioteer is one who escorts a soul from one reality to another reality. The word sutaka also relates to the Sanskrit word for mercury, one of the Sanskrit words for mercury, which is said to be able to go under, and we see that it does, these sort of what we call alchemical processes, so that it can go from a liquid to a solid and back to a liquid and back to a solid, and which are two states of beings. So this word sutaka is really about the experience of encompassing, because mercury is both liquid and a solid, a charioteer is both in the heavens and on the earth. So it's an experience that encompasses the transition. And it's said to apply to not only people being born and people dying, but to the people closely involved and connected with those processes of tremendous transition. So a midwife present at a birth, of course, the mother present at the birth, all the families, all the people who love that soul who's coming in or departing if it's at a deathbed. So a midwife of death might be a hospice nurse or volunteer. And then we have the family and the loved ones of the person who is dying or the people who are dying. And those of us who are present at these momentous moments of change and transition, we have one foot in one reality and one foot in another reality. And one of the realities we may be more comfortable with, we may be more familiar with, and the other one we may be much less familiar with, much less acquainted with. And so there's this, it's not a stable place to be. It's a inherently morphous state to be in, a very changeable state. So we've got one foot here and one foot there. And so it's said in India to be a very inauspicious time to focus on practical matters, numbers, details, business as usual kind of stuff. And one of the things, I don't know if you've heard this, Brody, but a lot of people who I've been connecting to in the last few days have a very hard time thinking and doing anything. And
yes.
There's this
treaty patients this week. There's this pall over people. And
right.
There's like that sense of being in this liminal space where we're not really sure that, yeah, that one foot in one world and one foot in the next, like that it's, yeah, it seems like completely derailing of plans and of even first assumptions. Like, what can we count on if things are going to be fundamentally different? That obviously changes your relationship to it. And it seems like there's definitely a kind of a deer in the headlights sense. I mean, when people are kind of, at least the people that I was holding space for yesterday in my practice, there's a lot of emotion and not a lot of clarity.
So this period, you know, we really enter it in a sincere way when we feel this altered state of reality. So it's considered to be a very inauspicious time to do practical things. And we've experienced that. We experience that as awe, as grief, as confusion, as shock, all of these things. And because it's an inherently morphous situation. So what it is considered to be is a very auspicious time to engage in meditation, in activities where we're consciously participating in relationship with our own prana or our own chi, our own energy patterns, and helping that energy move smoothly. That may involve meditation or spending sweet time in good company. It may involve actually doing some visualizations or qigong or tai chi or yoga or something gentle that specifically goes inside and melts away the obstructions to the free flowing of this prana. And obstructions are fear. My mother is in an assisted living facility and she relies very much on Medicaid. And I personally have this fear. Oh no, what if Medicaid goes away? What will I do then? And we each have these personal fears about our political climate and future and situations. And then there's global fears, but all of these things constrict us, you know, hold the breath and, you know, clench and clench against the fear. And when that happens, the prana, the life force, the chi doesn't move as smoothly. So for me, time, the Sutthaka period is said to be very auspicious for going in and allowing that energy to move more smoothly. And one of the reasons for this is that as we're in this amorphous sort of changeable transition, we don't know what's coming, where we are quite. It's like it softens the matrix in which we are established and this being, and it softens our being. You know, we have these neural pathways in our brain, throughout our nervous system, that is used to responding to reality in a certain way. And it has been created in a certain way in response to reality. And our reality is shifting. And so giving it time and space and allowing that to shift is sometimes perhaps the most useful thing to do. They say in India, you know, at this time is to allow that space. And there's a few interesting things we can do, I think, for that. And one is to cooperate with it. And by so, one way we can do that is staying in some kind of love, you know, love and connection create oxytocin, which softens the matrix in which impressions are made for us. And it allows more readily, it allows new impressions to be made. We don't necessarily know what those new impressions are. Like Brody, you said, you know, what is mine to do? You asked that beautiful question, what is mine to do? And at the moment for me, it feels like acceptance first and allowing things to repattern and what to do, allowing that to become clear rather than pulling the mind into it right now with all its fears and analysis and projections and conclusions, and because that has a very limited value right now. Something maybe we can talk about in a little bit, but
yeah,
keeping that out of the way, you know.
Absolutely. Where I go with that, like in Chinese medicine, we think about the cycles of the seasons and the cycle of life in general, and that here we are in fall. We're in this time of letting go. And it's like a death, right? It's a death of everything that's been alive so far this year, and a pulling in of the sap from the trees. You know, like there's this pulling in, this pratyahara, that is sort of like withdrawing the senses from the world, coming into ourselves, hibernating season. You know, like that basically there's a letting go, and then we move into winter where like we don't know what's going to come up in the spring. We don't know. You know, it's this time of dormancy, and then only later is it time that we kind of like get the vision of what's going to emerge and the new growth, the new cycle begins. But winter is usually, I mean, just if we think about like our ability as a species to survive. Like, winter was a scary time. Winter was like, what's going to happen? And like, do I have what it takes to make it through this? And that pulling inward and preserving what's important to preserve.
Oh, I love that you brought the seasons into this, because I've been with the Sutika thing. I've been thinking about the relevance of birth and death to where we are. And it's so true. You know, we are experiencing the death of something. You know, everybody is, no matter what, no matter from which vantage point we are around this political totem that's going on. It's not really like it's two sides, which side you're on. It's more like all sides of this political totem are experiencing some kind of death in some way, because there's this transition. And we don't really know what the birth is. You know, the new president of the United States doesn't take office until January 20th. And it's going to be spring before activity really may start. And so we are at the cusp of a death right now. We are at least in North America, we are entering into fall, which is the death time. And it is precisely the wrong time to act and do something.
Yeah.
And to act before we rearrange and before we're nourished by going inside, I think would be, according to the natural rhythms of things, it seems like that would be premature.
Mm-hmm.
That move into action at a time where nature is calling for inaction and going within and gathering strength and being nourished before the action happens.
Yeah, especially with that whole liminal space, sands shifting under our feet. It's like, yeah, it definitely makes sense to not act until we know what we're stepping into.
Yeah. And the fact that it is considered to be a very auspicious time to meditate and go within and unbecome what we've become. We've become all these patterns and fears and so forth. And to unbecome those patterns and allow things to soften and rearrange in the best possible way. I do feel like things rearrange. You know, when I've had dear friends pass away, it feels like the fabric of reality is rearranging, and the hole that they leave when they depart, it's like that hole needs to be filled in. And I always feel like there's this period of time in India, they talk about 2 weeks, but if there's someone I've been very close to in my life who passes away, I feel like that extends to some degree or another for a full year. But certainly for 2 weeks after a death is this time of this hole filling in. Like, we had these hopes and dreams and plans and whatever, and now this person isn't there to be part of that. And they've been, you know, this set of ideas or this person or so has we've been attached to that in a certain way. It's become part of who we are in a way, and an identity. And so we ourselves are experiencing some kind of a death as our identity rearranges around the new reality. I want to go back to, if we may, to something we started to talk about a little bit, about the role of the mind in all this. Can we talk about that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
One of the things that has struck me, on all sides of the political totem over the election season, is our new relationship to facts and truth. And this whole, we will now fact check the candidates and what, you know, this kind of thing, and how little stake many of us put in the quote unquote facts, and whether someone is staying true to the quote unquote facts or not. And I think something that's become quite clear is, many, many of us don't believe candidates when they're talking. And so it almost doesn't matter what they're saying, because what we've found, you know, we've paid homage to such a degree to the results of tests and statistical studies and polls for so long. And what I think we're all beginning to be a little less naive about and a little bit more on board with the reality of is that a lot of these so-called facts are not facts. They are They are data that has been arranged in certain ways for the convenience of a certain of a certain belief system and presented as a fact. Whether this is something along the lines of funding for a study about a drug, and the funding comes from the company that will profit the most from the selling of this drug, and therefore they create a study that is, of course, going to show the drug in a positive light. But it's really, there's so many ways you can screw up a study, and by screw up, I mean you can manipulate the findings to your benefit, and there's so many ways for that to happen. And so we can't really tr and so we can't really trust the results of the studies many times. There's the question of which studies actually even get published, and just the sexy ones get published. So, for example, if you have a supplement or a drug or something coming to market, and you have 37 studies on it, and 36 of them find that there are bad side effects, but one says no, then that one, which is an outlier, is likely to be the one that will get published. So then you've got a very, if even if you're a very a doctor who's extremely conscientious and about your patients and what you're giving them, and you've studied all the published studies, the published studies are a tiny fraction of what studies have actually been done. It's just the published studies. They're the just the sexy results. And so even when we are very dedicated and conscientious, finding what is the truth, what is a fact, is very difficult. And so we're all starting to get a handle on that now. So when, and we can all see from the results of this election how accurate polls are, and statistics are from studies and from polls and from other things. And so we get, my point is, we don't know what's a fact anymore. It used to be Encyclopedia Britannica. You want a fact? Go there, right? But now there's so much information and sorting. So how do we make a decision? We're starting to just do it on gut. Do we like this person or not? Do they resonate with our identity or not? And it's one of the reasons that I think it's useful to find something beyond the mind and beyond emotions that we feel we can rely on.
And that sounds like a spiritual question.
Well, it is a spiritual question, and I think it has mental, emotional, and physical ramifications, how we deal with that. You know, in Ayurveda, we're always asking, is a condition, is it physical, mental, or spiritual? And oftentimes it's hard to separate all of these, right?
The idea that, coming back to fear for a moment too, that just as in the creation of what is true or what is factual, there's a lot of room for that to be manipulated. It's certainly not this empirical thing. Actually, a few weeks ago, I was talking about acupuncture research with Matthew Bauer, and he was talking about how just that are things being studied in the right way such that we can actually appreciate the power of the medicine. What is the proper dosage? How should this be studied? How should this be looked at? And I got to thinking after that conversation that there's so many different ways of knowing. Culturally, being identified with our minds and being identified with our opinions, I think it's really easy to get convinced that the primacy of reason and the mind in general is the only way to know things and is the only, and that's the default thing that we use to guide the decision-making process, and how it actually, like what you're saying about getting to somewhere beyond the intellect and beyond emotions that can inform what there is to do. There are so many different ways of knowing if we're open to looking at them.
It's actually, it's a big piece of my second book, How the Art of Medicine Makes This Science More Effective. Such a pithy, short, memorable title. which is, how do we know what we know? And because one of the, in Ayurvedic medicine, in the early texts, we have this idea that there's four qualities that an effective physician possesses: excellence in theoretical knowledge, lots of practice, dexterity and purity. Those are the four things. And dexterity sounds weird. I know that could be a whole other conversation, and purity sounds all puritanical, and that could be another conversation, and you know, practice, great. But this first one is interesting to look at. The excellence in theoretical knowledge is one of the qualities, that four qualities that the classics say that a effective physician possesses. And if we really look at that excellence in knowledge, if we look deeper into the Indian idea of what constitutes valid knowledge, we see that they say authority constitutes valid knowledge, and perception and inference. And if we look at these three things, they all get shot through full of holes, really, when we look at how valid they actually are. Because if we look at authority, the classics tell us that a true authority is someone who knows everything about the past, present, and future, and their knowledge is stable throughout all three times, right? Like how many really true authorities can we say we know, right? And so, and we've got the problem, even if we look to the scriptures and texts and things that are supposedly come from people of great authority, there's mistranslations, and a lot of stuff is lost, and there's things we don't understand and how to apply. So it's very difficult to find authority. And we've put, you know, I think double blind studies and platinum studies and, you know, gold standard studies and so forth. We've held these up as authorities, and we're seeing the fallibility of these authorities. So if we move on to then, let us say inference, which is another form of valid knowledge that they say. Inference is a fancy word for guess. It's really, that's not knowledge. It's, you know, and there's three kinds of inference. There's inference from the past, inference in the present, and inference from the future. So what I mean by that are, you know, I'll give you three examples from the classics. In the past, you know, if you see a woman who's pregnant, you infer that there was sex for her to conceive, right? You infer something in the past had to have happened for what you're seeing in front of you right now. In the present, if you see smoke, there's probably fire, something that you're seeing right now. And in the future, you know, if you plant a seed, you can infer that, you know, if you plant an apple seed, you can infer that an apple tree will grow. So, but these are all still guesses. You're guessing. They're not, they're considered a valid form of knowledge, but it's a guess. It's a fancy word for guess, inference. Yeah. And that leads me to sort of the last one, which actually comes in the middle in their list usually, which is perception. Like, how do we know what we know? From a certain point of view, we could say everything we know is what we perceive. We only know that which we perceive. Perceive being that we perceive from any of our five senses. Anything we see, hear, taste, touch, feel, right? That is then what we know. And we have certain limitations, of course, to our abilities to perceive things. We can only see so many colors in the spectrum. We can, but even within that, we often only see what we want to see or how we want to see something. And there's physical limitations to the senses and cultural limitations to how we've learned to perceive things. But there are, and I talk about this in the book, there are ways to cultivate the five senses so that we can cultivate a deeper sense of communication and knowing through those senses. And I think that that's a worthwhile endeavor in life, because it gets underneath the facts and statistics and emotions. I mean, we don't want to glorify emotions either. Emotions are certainly unstable.
Sure. But that idea of that inferences are guesses, that I think reinforces the notion of coming back to the present moment, because what we think is going to happen in the future isn't here yet, and it may not come to pass. And that it helps me to come back from spinning into pessimism or into fear, to remember that we don't know everything from this current vantage point.
Yeah, but what, you know, absolutely. So what can, and especially if now is not the time to spring into action, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it certainly has its place. It would be very, very, very useful for us to be educated about history in order to make a good inference about how our behavior is likely to impact the future so that we can make the wisest steps possible. In a situation that's going on right now, I think that the brain is not as clear and sharpened as it can be when it's in the state of shock, when it's experiencing sutaka, this transition period. And it's not the best time to kind of bring that on board and use the intellect. And, but I think it is a very useful time to go inside and say, okay, well, what do I know now? What do I feel now? What do I hear inside now? What do I see inside now? And take that outward focused perceiving, ability to perceive, and turn that momentum around inward. And this is what the Taoists call Naquan, inner vision. And so it's not like spiritual enlightenment. It's just turning the focus inward. I often like the idea and experience of prana following focus. So the prana or chi follows what we're focusing on. So if we're focusing outside and perceiving things outside, our chi, our prana, our attention is getting scattered outside. And if we turn that momentum around and look inside and try to awaken our internal sensory apparatus and see what are we hearing, what are we seeing, what are we feeling going on inside right now, that is a tangible reality. We know, we go inside and we feel, oh, I feel constricted or sticky here or there, tight here. And let me open that up and let me see what's going on in there, feel what's going on in there. You know, all these sensory, the five sensory perceptions, we talk about them as distinct, but once we go inside and turn our attention inside, it's a combined experience. The experience of seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, feeling, smelling, these sensory experiences combine and commingle and yield a combined sensory experience. So we see, hear, feel, touch, taste, smell inside ourselves. We kind of go inside ourselves and look around and see what's there. And by in so doing, we're feeding attention. We're focusing inside that the prana or the chi follows that focus. We're feeding that prana inside, and it's stabilizing ourselves. And I think this is a good time for internal stabilization.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Not to mention the fact that the step one towards getting towards that inner awakening, the inner sensory capacity, the first step is shutting off everything coming at us, you know, like just getting out of the noise, getting out of everything in the external world, whether that's through the media or just through the noise of our daily lives, making time to go inward, just even before that sensory apparatus gets turned on, just the closing off and pulling in, that's going to be therapeutic immediately, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And again, like you said, bringing the seasons into it, that's the natural flow of where the seasons are taking us right now. You know, if it's sort of tempting to want to jump into action. Okay, let's act right now. but it's like, you know, running around with chickens with our heads cut off if it's not mature, if it's not coming from a place of stability. You know, the story is not over, right? This isn't the end of the story, right? I mean, one of the quotes that's been helping me a lot in the last few days, one by Kabir, and he says, "Slowly, slowly, oh mind, everything in its own pace happens. Gardener may water with 100 pots, fruit arrives only in its season." And I love that. And also kind of going back out into the, like, let's go into space and look at the globe and we see it looks round, kind of pulling back and let's look at this with a larger perspective. I've also read a few things in the last few days talking about Mughal emperors who were tyrants who died 300 years ago, and now the birds are crapping on their graves and nobody's
taking
care of
exactly.
them. And whereas, you know, if you go to the cremation site of a saint, often there's many people meditating there and lighting incense and chanting and engaging in loving behavior of people who died many, many more than 300 years ago. And so, you know, things come and things go. And we are not the only people who wake up to a world that we don't know what's going to happen anymore. There's in this world, in the current day, and in the decade, previous decades leading up to today, there are so many people and so many souls in so many countries waking up, not knowing if they're going to survive the day or if their kids will survive the day or if they'll get bombed or killed or disappeared. We're joining the ranks of people who don't know what's around the corner, and none of us do know what's around the corner. So it's not a unique experience. It's just a unique experience to us, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of quotes that have been helpful, I've been appreciating, Rudyard Kipling's quote, we should reject as frauds, those two imposters, victory and defeat.
Mm-hmm.
It's like nothing's settled. Nothing's over. It's not ever over. So I want to circle back to what's helpful, because I think that that is, by way of recapping, I guess, a few things that we've talked about: turning our attention inwards, not acting, having the courage to not jump right into action, keeping good company, you mentioned, and actually that's sort of how we started this, is that idea of, you know, coming together with people who can help us stay in love, coming together to support one another and to cultivate a sense of, like, no matter what's happening out there, we can still be in touch with something peaceful.
I love that. And can I read something that helped me as well? This is from a talk that my guru gave about 30 years ago. He quotes a saint saying, "No one is our enemy if we become cool. Become cool, and everybody will have mercy on you and will help you." And then my guru says, and the saint is Kabir that he's quoting, and he says, so my guru says, "Now Kabir Sahib says that if you clean your mirror, then you will see the whole creation clearly. If we make ourselves as our friend, we will see all the world as our friend." That is why Kabir Sahib is saying that nobody is our enemy in this world if we stop allowing the mind to do enmity to us. So it does feel
beautiful,
very much to me, like a time to go inside our own selves, clean our own selves in a way, remove the obstacles to free-flowing prana, free-flowing chi, free-flowing life force, because only in that experience, I think, can we take mature action down the road, whenever that time is, where action becomes clear to do.
Well, and it also, I think, speaks to, yes, okay, so eliminating the barriers to love within ourselves, like not seeing anyone as the enemy, but that also means accepting responsibility for complicity in a system that, or in an outcome that we don't think we want. And it, like, to me, that means that sort of like calling us to a higher standard of alignment with values and making sure that those values aren't just something that we think of. It's not just like, oh, I think of myself as someone who believes in social justice, but how is that actually translating? And that's sort of, I mean, that's sort of for me where it comes back to the what is mine to do. It seems to call for a higher level of engagement. And
I believe that deciding with the mind what that level of engagement is may not be as useful as going in and preparing our own internal terrain so that when action needs to be taken, it is from a very clear place and it is very clear that an action needs to happen.
Absolutely.
Because there is a time for action, and there's a time for non-action. And I think it's often, especially perhaps in U.S. culture, taken to be courageous to do something. Sometimes it's courageous to not do something and to wait until the time of action is the ripe time for action.
Well, I think that that's absolutely true, and especially when it comes to the the big stuff, like, you know, like, what am I doing with my energy? What am I doing with my potential? What, you know, that sort of these bigger questions of purpose that absolutely, like, there is, that has to be something that where we wait for right action to arise by itself, like the Tao Te Ching talks about. At the same time, it also feels like it's pretty easy to know, or it's pretty easy to recognize when something is out of alignment and to be able to correct that, you know, and to be able to, to correct course or to change course. And that, I think, just requires acknowledgement and willing to accept that that's the case.
I agree, like, that it's easy to know that if we're practiced in it. And this is what having a daily practice is about, is to look inside and be familiar with the terrain there, so that we are clear when the moment of action comes, that it is the moment of action, and we're clear when the non-action moment, that that's what's going on too. Yeah.
Well, Claudia, I really appreciate you taking the time to have this chat with me today. It's really, you are such good company, and thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, we're all part of this conversation. Thanks everybody for being here, and thanks Brody for creating the space.
And if you enjoyed this conversation and you'd like to stay in touch with Claudia, you can find her online at drclaudiawelch.com. Apart from spending time in meditation and abiding with love, letting go of the notion of who I think I am as I let my identity unravel a bit in this time of change, it occurs to me that I can also give some energy away in the form of money. Contributing to organizations that support social justice for women, LGBT people, people of color, and of all faiths feels like it's in alignment with who I am no matter what happens next, and it feels relatively low risk. So that's one thing, in addition to what Claudia and I talked about, that I think I can satisfy the part of me that wants to take action even as I contemplate what else is mine to do. What do you think? I'd love to hear how you're navigating change in your life and what challenges you're experiencing, as well as what other aspects of health and well-being you'd like to hear about on this show. I'd love to get to know you better. Feel free to shoot me an email at brody@brodywelch.com, that's Brody with an I-E and Welch with a C-H, or reach out on Facebook at A Healthy Curiosity. Thanks for listening. This episode of A Healthy Curiosity is brought to you by the coaching branch of BrodyWelch.com. Yes, that is me. In early 2017, I'm going to be opening up my schedule to coach just a handful of people one-on-one who are interested in showing up differently in the world. If you're wanting to feel more calm, confident, have more energy, ditch an old pattern, set a boundary, or change the one thing that you know will change everything, I would love to support you. Deep, transformative change can be hard, and it's way easier when you have someone in your corner who believes in you, who can amplify your strength, and who has lots of tools in her toolbox. If you'd like that person to be me, email me at brody@brodywelch.com. That's Brody with an I-E and Welch with a C-H, and let me know that you're interested. Now back to today's show. Thanks for listening today. For more episodes of A Healthy Curiosity, you can visit the iTunes store. If you appreciated today's show, please leave us a review. This helps other people to find the podcast. You could also head to brodywelch.com, where you can find free self-care resources, learn more about Chinese medicine, and let me know what you'd like to hear about on future episodes. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, be good to yourself.